From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. These are true ghost stories. The first is in an Irish manor house by Maurice Quinton. Two young men and a dog witness a dramatic scene in detail which took place in the author's ancestral home 5 generations before. In the winter of 1920, a time of great trouble in Ireland, I returned to Derrymore for the Christmas holidays. I brought with me my cousin and good friend, Michael. Derrymore, a large stone house of castle-like proportions with lofty rooms and draughty corridors, was located in the south of Ireland. It lay deep in the country, 15 miles from a town, and 3 from our nearest neighbor. It was Boxing Day. Michael and I, both 15 years old and tired after a long day of hunting, had settled down in the great hall in front of a blazing fire. My parents had left early that morning on their annual visit to relatives, and were not expected back until late that night. One heavily shaded lamp lighted the area where we sat. The shadows danced on the old stone walls which reached up to the balcony on the second floor and then on up to the roof. Just visible to our left was the wide sweep of the bottom of the staircase, and to our right the keyboard of the great pipe organ. Derrymore had been the home of my family for centuries. The house and lands had come into our possession about 1510, and few changes had taken place over the years. Like most estates that old, many legends had been woven around it. Only one, however, has persisted. This told how the final act of a terrible tragedy took place in the very room in which we were sitting. We sat half-dozing with my terrier Rory stretched full length asleep at our feet. All of us were warm and comfortable. Suddenly the dog sat up, growling deep in his throat. We saw him look quickly about the room, then stop and stare in the direction of the organ. Watching him intently, I saw the hackles rise on his back and neck, his lips curl up, showing his teeth, and a look of fear come into his eyes. He growled again. Then very suddenly, with a pitiful whine, he was under my legs, shivering and cowering against the sofa. Michael and I were now sitting bolt upright, staring at each other. I knew that something was very wrong, and could well imagine that his heart was pounding like mine. I saw the color drain out of his face and felt my mouth go dry with fear. Then it happened. Softly and imperceptibly, the organ began playing. We were now staring, half hypnotized, at the keyboard, where a figure slowly resolved itself into the shape of a man seated there. He wore a high collared coat with lace at his throat and wrists, knee breeches, and silk stockings. His head and face, which we saw in profile, were not clear, seeming to be in shadow. I knew at once, however, that it was the figure of my ancestor, Henry Quinton, who had died at that organ in this room 160 years ago. His own journal had told us of the tragedy that had led to this moment, and Father Kevin O'Sullivan, his friend and the village priest, had recorded not only finding him dead at his organ, but also finding the body of another outside the house. The music he was playing was beautiful and unearthly, the tempo and volume increasing until the huge hall was filled with sound. Abruptly it ended, bringing a silence far more terrifying than the sound of the organ. I lifted my eyes and felt a shock run through me. The figure was sprawled motionless over the keyboard, his head resting on his arm. "Oh, my God, Maurice, look!" I heard Michael say in a low, hoarse whisper, and following his gaze, I saw the figure of a woman coming down the stairs. I knew that this could only be Kathleen, whose poor body had been discovered outside the house by Father Kevin just before he had entered to find Henry as he was now. Kathleen had been lady's maid to Henry's wife and later nurse to their children. She had come to the family as a girl of 14 from her home in the mountains of Connemara. She was a remarkable woman, for not only was she very lovely, but she had a character that matched her beauty. Her kindness and gentleness was known far and wide, and she was dearly loved by all who came in contact with her. Kathleen stood motionless at the bottom of the stairs for a second or two, looking straight at the organ. I shrank back against the sofa, realizing that if she were to move towards that still figure, she would pass directly between where we were sitting and the fireplace. Now she was coming toward us with no sense of haste or urgency. It was at this moment that an amazing thing happened. My fear vanished, and I was overcome by an intense feeling of sorrow and pity for this lovely woman and what she was about to find when she reached the organ. I knew with complete certainty that on that night 160 years ago, when Kathleen had come down those stairs, as we had seen her do on this night, she did not yet know that Henry was dead. At that moment, I would have given anything to have had the moment or the power to stop her from reaching that poor still figure. She passed very close, directly in front of us, and as she did so, Rory came out from under my legs and watched her go by, apparently without fear. I saw her clearly. She was dressed in black and had about her shoulders a dark blue hooded cloak, peculiar to the south of Ireland. She had raven hair, lovely deep-set eyes, and a sensitive mouth. I have never seen a woman so beautiful. When she reached the organ, she bent down as though to speak, but neither of us heard a sound. After a moment, she reached out her hand, laying on his shoulder and bending towards him again. Slowly, I could see the realization come to her that Henry was dead. She lifted her hand from his shoulder and stood looking at him for a few moments. She then knelt down by the silent figure and bowed her head as though in prayer. I knew that I was witnessing the saddest sight of my young life. Slowly she got to her feet and, reaching out her hand once more, gently placed it on his head in a gesture of farewell. She then turned and, with the same unhurried step with which she had come, she repassed us with her head held high and an expression on her face of the most tender and infinite compassion. She moved on to the staircase and up the stairs with never a backward glance. When she had disappeared from our sight, we looked back to the organ, but there was no one there. Dazed and shaken, we got to our feet, our only thought being to get away from the great hall and its recent associations. What we had just witnessed was a dramatization of the death of my great-great-grandfather, a story I had known since childhood. Father Kevin had written an account of it that was kept with the rest of our family papers. Upon the return of my parents somewhat later that night, our story was received with a great deal of sympathy, but also with some skepticism. However, their attitude changed the next morning when it was discovered that the window of the room once occupied by Kathleen, and since unused and kept locked, was wide open, the same window from which she had fallen or jumped. It was directly beneath this window that her body had been found by Father Kevin. Following the death of my father some years after this incident, the family papers came into my possession. Among them I found that he had recorded the episode I have just related, giving all the pertinent facts. John Lafarge, Ghost of 10th Street by Elizabeth Archer. The famous artist John Lafarge died years ago, but he has since been seen in his Greenwich Village studio several times and by several people. Although ghosts are usually associated with quiet country lanes, cemeteries, and antique castles, a building that had until recently stood in the center of New York City was apparently as haunted as any of the more familiar habitats of ghosts. Number 51 West 10th Street was the oldest of the artist studio buildings in America. Only recently were its owners forced to bow to the inevitable demand for city housing and allow the erection of a modern apartment building in its place. It was a blow to many nostalgic New Yorkers. Many men with great names in American art lived there in their time. Even during the demolition, the traditional hospitality of 51's old days continued, and anyone was welcome to visit the studios. And it was claimed by many visitors and tenants that the ghost of artist John Lafarge, who died in 1910, was still roaming the site. Down the block, on the corner of 10th Street and 5th Avenue, stands the Church of the Ascension, behind the altar of which hangs Lafarge's painting of the Ascension. The most famous legend of the studios is concerned with this painting. In Studio 22 at number 51, Lafarge did the groundwork on the Ascension, considered by many experts to be this country's finest church decoration. The painting was done, hung in place. Lafarge at the time had just returned from a trip to Japan with Henry Adams and was much influenced in his work by what he had seen in the Orient. To get the rich tones he wanted in the finished work, he first primed his canvas with four coats of heavy white lead instead of the lighter zinc coating ordinarily used on murals. When he ordered it hung, the chassis couldn't support the heavy load and collapsed. Lafarge is notified and ordered a new and stronger chassis constructed, supervising its hanging himself. This time the canvas stayed in place. Years went by. Lafarge's grandson, Oliver, the future novelist, was growing up, spending much of his time with his grandfather in his studio at number 51. The legend is that one day Oliver, working across the street, was told that the painting in the church had fallen again. He and his companions dashed down the block to the church and learned both that the painting had indeed fallen and that his grandfather had just died. And that's where the ghost story starts. The painting fell, they say, at the instant that John Lafarge died. The immediate suggestion is that the heavy priming had caused the fall, but Lafarge was a man of many talents, including architecture. He is usually credited with being a founder of the American School, and there are many buildings standing today for which this master architect drew plans 75 years ago. But in the hanging of the painting, something was wrong. The construction of the chassis may have been Lafarge's one mistake, and according to the most recent inhabitants of number 51, it explains why the ghost of John Lafarge has been seen so many times around the building he worked in and loved. They insisted that the restless spirit of the old man kept coming back to haunt the studios, searching for the original plans in order to find out just what made the painting fall. To an artist and a craftsman, that would be important. His ghost was first reported in the fall of 1944. Painter Fyodor Rimsky and his wife lived in Studio 22 then. Late one night, they came back from the opening of the opera. As they stepped into the entrance hall at a right angle to the studio, they noticed that a light was on and the door was open, though they had locked it when leaving. Rimsky walked through, pushed aside the heavy drapes separating the entrance from the studio, and stopped short. A single lamp midway down into the room cast little light in the two-story high, 36-foot-long room, but he could see a strange man behind a large chair in the library corner at the opposite end. He was wearing a tall black hat. and a dark billowy velvet cloak was draped around him. Rimsky quickly pushed his wife behind him, telling her to stay there, and rushed across the room to where the stranger sat. But the man, dressed in the costume of the latter part of the last century, vanished. Later, Rimsky described the incident to a previous owner of the building, an avid historian of its past, who showed him some old pictures associated with Number 51 and some of its former tenants. In two of them, John Lafarge was seated dressed as Rimsky had described the stranger, but the interested ex-owner pointed out that ball dress was uncommon, even in the 90s. John Lafarge had been known for affecting such attire. Rimsky, a European lately arrived in America, knew nothing of Lafarge, had never seen his picture. On another evening, 3 years after the night at the opera and its strange aftermath, the Rimskys were entertaining some close friends, among them William Weber, an advertising man. Weber was known by his friends to have had physical and psychical experiences and was often teased about them. Frail and sensitive, he disliked his own predilection towards extrasensory perception and dismissed any discussion of the supernatural with a shudder. To the chagrin of Rimsky and the other tenants, it was never possible to engage him in conversation about ghosts. Weber, his wife, and two other guests at the party sat around the small table chatting when Mrs. Weber noticed her husband had dropped out of the conversation. His face had blanched and his lips were tight and drawn. She followed his gaze to the tall cabinet opposite where finished paintings were stored. In a hoarse voice, Weber whispered to her, "Do you see that man in the cloak and top hat over there?" His wife looked across the room again. There was no one there. The two companions at the table, overhearing the whispered conversation, laughed and said, "That must be Lafarge." Others joined the group, amusement quieted as Weber described in detail a man dressed in exactly the same garb as that worn by the mysterious stranger Rimsky had seen 3 years before. The door to the hall was locked on the inside, and as it was late at night, so was the downstairs entrance to the building. A newcomer would have been spotted at once. All the guests had been there for hours. Weber had never heard the legend of the ghost of John Lafarge, or of his previous visitation to Studio 22, and he did not know that Lafarge had ever occupied it. Though the ghost had never done any harm, Weber died shortly afterward. The ghost rustled in and out of Studio 22 many times after that, pushing drapes aside and opening windows, but wasn't seen again until he visited John Allen Maxwell in 1948. All the studios in Number 51 were connected. Inner flights of steps and doors led from one level to another. The building was planned on the model of European ateliers so that painters could work and visit easily in their neighbor studios. In his time, Lafarge was no exception to this friendly rule, which perhaps explains his search for the old plans in John Allen Maxwell's studio. Maxwell, the historical illustrator, had the studio up a flight of stairs and down the hall, the top of the floor of his joining the end corner of the ceiling of Rimsky's studio. Connecting stairs had been walled over since Lafarge's day, along with Lafarge's secret restroom, hidden somewhere in this area. Only the dust-covered window could be seen from outside. It was here that Rimsky felt Lafarge's ghost had his abode, walled in like the golem, sleeping through the day and close to the premises for roaming through the night. After searching Rimsky's studio several times, evidently unsuccessfully, the ghost apparently began looking about in Maxwell's studio. In the spring of 1948, the spirits of John Lafarge and his wife made their first visit to Maxwell. According to the astonished artist, both were dressed in the clothes of the time when Lafarge had planned his mural, The Ascension. It was an embarrassing episode for Maxwell. It had been a warm day, and the artist had finished a job. Tired, he decided to nap. Stripping to the skin, he tossed the cover from a couch and slipped under a sheet, then fell quickly asleep. Sometime later, he was suddenly and sharply awakened. The room was dark. He tried to read the clock face across the room, but could not. He looked up at the skylight and judged it to be about 1 or 2 in the morning. As he gradually wakened, he had the feeling that someone was in the room. His vision grew accustomed to the gloom, and the illustrator saw a woman, taller than average, bending directly over him. Aware of his nudity, he crouched down in the bed. The woman was lifting his sheet, straightening it. She repeated this strange operation 2 as though the couch were not smooth enough to suit her, or as though she were shaking it out, looking for something. And then Maxwell saw a man standing behind her. Neither of them seemed to see the illustrator. The man was staring at an old wooden filing cabinet standing against the wall at the foot of the couch. Then he opened a drawer, looked in it, closed it. Maxwell tried to distinguish the faces of the couple, but it was too dark. Still, he could see that the woman wore a light red dress to the last century, and the man a suit, with a white shirt and a dark cravat of the same period. Maxwell was not disturbed by this. He even thought that they might be models dressed in costume, working for an artist in the building. As he stared, trying to identify them, the woman turned to the man as though to say something. Evidently, he thought better of it, and walked off toward the dark room at the opposite end of the studio. The man stood uncertainly for a minute, then walked back to the cabinet he'd been looking through and leaned on it, head in hand. Maxwell, by now upset, thought the intruders must be burglars. He had locked a single door to the studio from the inside before retiring. At any rate, the strangers had no business in the room. He balled his fist and struck the stranger hard, shouting, "Put your hands up!" His voice was heard through the building. Only the white tabs on the filing cabinet stared him in the face. Maxwell nursed his bruised thumb and looked around in astonishment. The man was gone. He ran to the dark room, clutching his sheet around him. No one was there. He ran to the door. It was still locked from the inside. Throwing on lights, he glanced at the skylight. Nothing could be seen but the sky overhead. It was a drop of 150 feet to the ground 3 flights below, another 50 feet up to the top of the building on the other side. The injured thumb was all he had to show for his adventure. It slowly dawned on him that Lafarge and his wife must have been the visitors to his room, still in quest of the plan of the mural which fell. Casual visitors to number 51 complained of an ill wind whistling through the halls, a momentary chill as of something passing close by unseen. They hurried by the walled-in private restroom of the old master. How many heard these ghost stories before visiting number 51? It's impossible to tell. At other times, the artist debunked such anecdotes about the place. The following story, told by Maxwell, illustrates how stories about the building might have accumulated. A few years before the building's demolition, a model married to a photographer with a studio there attended a party in Maxwell's studio where he told a story of his 2 visitors. She said, "I believe you. One night when I was coming up the stairs, I saw a woman in a 19th-century costume float down this very hall and disappear at the other end." Maxwell never told her that the night of her vision he'd been doing a drawing for the cover of a historical novel and had kept his model working late. Her vision was his model going down the hall in costume. However, on another occasion, after telling the story of his ghostly visitors, Maxwell jokingly said to a guest as she left, "Just scream if anything goes wrong and we'll come running." As he stood talking with some of the men present, they heard frantic footsteps down the hall. The woman came bursting round the corner screaming, "That man! That man!" Glass windows enclosed the square corridors which surrounded an open court, so that it was possible to see from one side across the other. Maxwell and his guest looked at the corridor opposite. There was no man there, nor on the 3rd or on the 2nd floor, visible below. Gasping, the guest described the strange appearance of the man she'd seen that caused her to dash back into the building. As she passed under one of the old gas lamps of 51, flickering in a draft from the open corridor, she noticed a strange figure leaning back against the wall. He was extremely tall, ungainly and thin, and his balance was irregular and wobbly. Dressed in rags borrowed from another era, with what had been a red silk tie crossed and recrossed round the shrunken throat, he looked like a figure from an old print. But it was his face, cadaverous and unearthly, that had made her run back. Under the unsteady gaslights, it showed a skeletal grayish white on the bones of the countenance, thin flesh and large ears cropping out from behind its sides hugged it. The eyes, sunken and faded blue, stared sightlessly from their sockets, and the skull showed bony through sparse hair. The head bobbed lifelessly. The arms jangled at his sides. It was the only time the face of the ghost had been seen. Terribly frightened, the woman ran for the safety of the studio. Lights through the glass windows reflected blank walls on either side of the stairwell she had descended, and there were no outside chimneys for a man to go up. He had disappeared, but there was no place for him to go and not be seen. Maxwell and his guest walked around the halls, knocking on doors, waking tenants. No one had seen a stranger in the building that evening. He'd seemingly vanished, so it must have been a ghost. Possibly the long-departed John LaFarge. Not much has changed in the appearance of No. 51 since it was built. Dull red bricks glowed softly in light reflected from the original carriage lamps outside the main door. Inside in the vestibule to the right, the house porter had the seat once held by a special policeman assigned to the beat, and a few years ago they fitted the old gas fixtures with modern electric bulbs at the city's insistence. But the old parlor stoves that heated the studios of John LaFarge and his friends nearly a century still warmed the artist of the 1950s, and by night ghosts walked the quarters of No. 51. And who knows, perhaps ghosts still roam the quarters of the modern apartment building standing in 51's old place on 10th Street. The Scratched Cheek, taken from the American Society for Psychic Research. The mother had accidentally scarred her dead daughter's face, and the daughter's ghostly apparition bore this scarlet mark 9 years later. The case history which follows concerns an apparition perceived more than 9 years after the death of the person whom the apparition was believed to represent. Commenting on this case, the noted British psychic researcher Frederick W. H. Myers wrote in The Human Personality: A Survival of Bodily Death, that such an apparition may be considered a manifestation of persistent personal memory, or as indication that some kind of force is being exercised after death, which is in some way connected with a person previously known on Earth. The case history originally published in the Journal of the British Society for Psychic Research, London, is uniquely characterized by the statement that the apparition had a scratch on her cheek, a condition of special emotional and possibly evidential impact. Although reported in the British publication, the account had been made available to the American Society for Psychic Research by a Boston informant identified only as Mr. F.G. However, prominent research professor Josiah Royce and Dr. Richard Hodgson vouched for the reliability of all the persons whose testimony was utilized in the report. The first letter, addressed to the American Society for Psychic Research and dated January 11, 1888, read as follows. Sir, replying to the recently published request of your Society for actual occurrences of physical phenomena, I respectfully submit the following remarkable occurrence to the consideration of your distinguished Society, with the assurance that the event made a more powerful impression on my mind than the combined incidents of my whole life. I have never mentioned it outside of my family and a few intimate friends, knowing well that few would believe it, or else ascribe it to some disordered state of my mind at the time. But I well know I never was in better health or possessed a clearer head and mind than at the time it occurred. In 1867, my only sister, a young lady of 18 years, died suddenly of cholera in St. Louis, Missouri. My attachment for her was very strong, and the blow was a severe one to me. A year or so after her death, the writer became a commercial traveler, and it was in 1876, while on one of my Western trips, that the event occurred. I had drummed the city of St. Joseph, Missouri, and had gone to my room at the Pacific House to send in my orders, which were unusually large ones, so I was in a very happy frame of mind indeed. My thoughts, of course, were about these orders, knowing how pleased my house would be at my success. I had not been thinking of my late sister, or in any manner reflecting on the past. The hour was high noon, and the sun was shining cheerfully into my room. While busily smoking a cigar and writing out my orders, I suddenly became conscious that someone was sitting on my left, with one arm resting on the table. Quick as a flash, I turned and distinctly saw the form of my dead sister, and for a brief second or so looked her squarely in the face, and so sure was I that it was she, that I sprang forward in delight, calling her by her name, and as I did so, the apparition instantly vanished. Naturally, I was startled and dumbfounded, almost doubting my senses, but with a cigar in my mouth and pen in hand, with the ink still moist on my letter, I satisfied myself I had not been dreaming and was wide awake. I was near enough to touch her, had it been a physical possibility, and noted her features, expression, and details of dress, etc. She appeared as if alive. Her eyes looked kindly and perfectly natural into mine. Her skin was so lifelike that I could see the glow of moisture on its surface, and on the whole there was no change in her appearance otherwise than when alive. Now comes the most remarkable confirmation of my statement, which cannot be doubted by those who know what I state actually occurred. This visitation, or whatever you may call it, so impressed me that I took the next train home, and in the presence of my parents and others I related what had occurred. My father, a man of rare good sense and very practical, was inclined to ridicule me, as he saw how earnestly I believed what I stated. But he too was amazed when later on I told them of a bright red line or scratch on the right-hand side of my sister's face, which I distinctly had seen. When I mentioned this, my mother rose trembling to her feet and nearly fainted away, and as soon as she sufficiently recovered her self-possession, with tears streaming down her face, she exclaimed that I had indeed seen my sister, as no living mortal but herself was aware of that scratch, which she had accidentally made while doing some little act of kindness after my sister's death. She said she well remembered how pained she was to think she should have unintentionally marred the features of her dead daughter, and that unknown to all, how she had carefully obliterated all traces of the light scratch with the aid of powder, etc., and that she had never mentioned it to a human being from that day to this. In proof, neither my father nor any of our family had detected it and positively were unaware of the incident. Yet I saw the scratch as bright as if just made. So strangely impressed was my mother that even after she had retired to rest, she got up and dressed, came to me, and told me she knew at least that I had seen my sister. A few weeks later, my mother died, happy in her belief she would rejoin her favorite daughter in a better world. In a further letter, Mr. F.G. added, "There was nothing of a spiritual or ghostly nature in either the form or dress of my sister. She appeared perfectly natural and dressed in clothing that she usually wore in life and which was familiar to me. From her position at the table, I could only see her from the waist up, and her appearance and everything she wore is indelibly photographed in my mind. I even had time to notice the collar and little breastpin she wore, as well as the comb in her hair, after the style then worn by young ladies. The dress had no particular association for me or my mother, no more so than others she was in the habit of wearing. But today, while I have forgotten all other dresses, pins, and combs, I could go to her trunk, which we have just left as it is, and pick out the very dress and ornaments she wore when she appeared to me. So well do I remember it. You are correct in understanding that I returned home earlier than I had intended, as it had such an effect on me that I could hardly think of any other matter. In fact, I abandoned a trip that had barely commenced and ordinarily would have remained on the road a month longer. Myers commented at this point that the apparent redness of the scratch in the face of the apparition goes naturally enough with the look of life in the face. The phantom did not appear as a corpse, but as a blooming girl, and the scratch showed as it would have shown if made during life. Dr. Hodgson visited Mr. F.G. later and sent the following notes dated St. Louis, April 16, 1890. In conversation with Mr. F.G., now 43 years of age, he says that there was a very special sympathy between his mother, sister, and himself. When he saw the apparition, he was seated at a small table about 2 feet in diameter and had his left elbow on the table. The scratch which he saw was on the right side of his sister's nose, about 3/4 of an inch long, and was a somewhat ragged mark. His home at the time of the incident was in St. Louis. His mother died within 2 weeks after the incident. His sister's face was hardly a foot away from his own. The sun was shining upon it through the open window. The figure disappeared like an instantaneous evaporation. Mr. G. has had other experience, but of a somewhat different character. Last fall, the impression persisted for some time of a lady friend of his, and he could not rid himself for some time of thoughts of her. He found out afterwards that she died at the time of the curious persistence of his impression. Mr. G. appears to be a first-class witness. Signed, R. Hodgson. Dr. Myers added these observations. I have ranked this case prima facie as a perception by the spirit of her mother approaching death. That coincidence is too marked to be explained away. The son is brought home in time to see his mother once more by perhaps the only means which would have succeeded, and the mother herself is sustained by the knowledge that her daughter loves and awaits her. Mr. Podmore has suggested in Phantasms of the Dead from another point of view that the daughter's figure was a mere projection from the mother's mind, a conception which has scarcely any analogy to support it. I think the very fact that the figure was not that of the corpse with a dull mark on which the regretful thoughts might dwell, but was that of the girl in health and happiness, with a symbolic red mark worn simply as a test of identity, goes far to show that it was not the mother's mind from whence that image came. As to the spirit's own knowledge of the fate of the body after death, other reported cases show that this specific form of post-mortem perception is not unusual. However explained, this case is one of the best attested and in itself one of the most remarkable that we possess. We may therefore class this as a case in which it is possible, though not of course provable, that the decedent was aware of the approaching death of a survivor. If the incident is correctly recorded, or if it is not a mere extraordinary coincidence, it certainly seems probable that recognition was intelligently aimed at.